Hi, everybody. This is Kathy Belsky, the Quantum Leap Let Light Unite show on UPRN Radio. And this is March 9th, 2018. And tonight I've got a special guest, Tara Judson Stareo.
Stareo.
Stareo, thank
Yes.
you.
Thank
She's a licensed marriage and family therapist. She wrote this incredible book called Sanity Lost and Found. Now, she was a bright and beautiful child brought up in an idyllic ranch setting. And as a young woman, she should have had it all. And instead, she fell prey to a psychopath who consumed more than a decade and a half of her life. And cult is a word we all know. Yep, we're going to talk about cults tonight. But few will ever have a reason to confront it in their own lives. Now, a cult is something other families might have to deal with, something that will impact other children, maybe, maybe not. But how do we become victims of our own irrationality? What makes us vulnerable to the predators among us? How vulnerable are we? Now, following on the anniversary of the Branch Davidian cult incident, and with the sentencing of the predator, Dr. Larry Nassar, and with harsh memory of Charlie Manson, predators and cults are again in the news cycle, but it does not take a cult or a cult leader to take advantage of our vulnerabilities. And Tara not only escaped being a victim, but she went on to assist others to not be victims. Welcome to the show, Tara.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, what an incredible story. I mean, being in a cult and then actually getting out of it. And, to me, that kind of reminds me of, if you want to help someone who's an alcoholic, you have to be the alcoholic and go through it.
It helps to have been there, done that in terms of helping people with this kind of form of abuse, psychological abuse, and emotionally devastating someone so that they don't have a good sense of self, and then we're easily controlled. That's how we become emotionally vulnerable, is we don't have a good grounded sense of who we are inside. So I think we could
Yeah.
all benefit from that. Excuse me.
Oh, do you think though that is because of how you were raised?
I think that it's a multifaceted process. There was a lot of distraction on the part of my parents, and so there was what we call emotional neglect. And then I endured several medical traumas and was molested at the age of 6, and kind of cobbled together my life. And then when I was in Peace Corps, it was probably the first time I had ever felt a fulfillment of what I was doing. I had these paranormal experiences that just completely, I felt like I was losing my mind, and the experience asked me to come back to the United States and share that life as we knew it on the planet Earth was not going to continue unless humans changed the way that they were living. And so more things kept happening, and so I did come back, and of course you know how well that message went over. And this guy was the Usually, he was really uniquely validating of this message, and I was incredibly vulnerable, very depressed, having failed in my attempts to share this message that I felt that I needed to do.
How
And
old
so
were you?
I was 29, old enough to know better, but I didn't know better. I didn't have the skills to seek out support, maybe go to therapy, and all I kept experiencing was rejection. And I studied a bunch of modalities thinking that this was going to help me share my message. And he promised me the moon, which is what cult leaders do. They prey on your vulnerabilities and then they insidiously take away your rights and your sense of self. And pretty soon you're brainwashed and you're in this trance where you don't even know who you are anymore.
What were some of the ways you were brainwashed?
Well, he had a has a master's degree in criminal psychology, and so how you break down a person is you find their weaknesses, you find what they're feeling guilty or ashamed about, and then you make those deeper and more significant. And that's what he did to all of us. You know, we all had histories that we weren't quite proud of. And so he used, you know, he confessed, asked us to confess, oh, you know, please tell me, it'll help you. And so we did. We needed to unburden ourselves of these emotional experiences that had been
Yeah,
troubling.
it kind of reminds me of what the priests do, especially the Jesuits back in the old days, where they would get everybody to confess so they knew exactly what was happening, and then they can use that against people.
Yes, that is how people are controlled. And once he knew all of these deep, dark secrets, then he started insidiously using them against them and against us. Jim Jones did the same thing. Just about every cult leader has these similar patterns because they break down our psyche, they break down our sense of who we are. And once our so-called rescuer becomes our perpetrator, it really is disorganizing to the mind. And what he did, what all cult leaders do, they cut you off from your social ties. And so he said, well, you know, what you've done has gotten you to this point. So doesn't it make sense to you to cut off from your past, your family, everything you've known from this point forward is new. You don't remember, you know, you can't reference anything called your past. And so it became a mental discipline, you know, to become more mindful. And then pretty soon it became a thing that we were scorned for, having thought of a familiar person, someone that we loved, an experience that we'd had, whether it was pleasurable or negative, it was all forbidden. And so as we kept failing, he kept increasing the shame, increasing the guilt, and then the feedback was harsher and harsher, and then eventually it became abusive. And then, of course, we were all socially withdrawn. As I say, we weren't allowed to contact the outside world, our
Does
family.
this group have a name? The
No,
cult?
it was this man's particular little version. He called it the program. But you know, there are many different people running their own little programs all over the world. But he called it the program.
How many people were in the group?
There were six of us that I, six including myself, that I knew of. He claimed there were more, but there were six women that I know of, myself included, that were involved, five others.
Were there
So
any
it's
other
really,
men?
oh no. Well, actually, there were two husbands of two of the women, but we never interacted with them. I mean, he was sexually involved with all of us. That's what cult leaders do. They cross your boundaries. And it's all for the service of the higher good. You know, this ideal is placed way above social norms. And if you know, if you, I wanted to get closer to God. So if I wanted to complete my mission to go get closer to God, I had to go along with all these other things that grew progressively more abusive.
Did any of the women have children by him?
One person did, yes.
Wow.
It is a wow.
Well, what also are some of the other methods used to take and keep control of cult victims? And, were the women in your group, your age? Were some very young?
We were all basically the same age. I think a few were maybe 10 years younger than most of us. That I think there were only two.
How old was he?
I think 1 year younger than me, so he would be like 67 now or something.
And how long ago was this that you were in the cult?
This was 20 years ago that I got out in 1991. It took me that long to decide whether to publish this because it reveals some behaviors that when a person is in their right mind, they would go, are you kidding? Why did you put up with that? And so it took a lot to acknowledge that I didn't know any better, therefore I didn't do any better, like Maya Angelou says, when you know better, you do better. And I was really basically brainwashed, and so I was supported by a therapist in writing it out, you know, journaling and pretty much describing the process, and I decided to publish it in hopes that others can recognize where their critical thinking is being compromised, where their choices are being controlled. I mean, this is, you know, a battered wife or someone, a spouse who's a batterer is doing no less the same things that a cult leader would do. It's just a cult involves more people. A relationship is usually just two people. But they use the same techniques, and people are bonded to the perpetrator through what we call a trauma bond. Do you know what the Stockholm syndrome is? Have you ever heard of that?
I have, but can you refresh my mind?
Absolutely. So there were these people that were taken hostage in, I think it was in a bank, and the terrorists actually murdered one of the hostages, and they were the terrorists, beg your pardon, were finally apprehended. But as the authorities were taking them away, the hostages were very cautious and very like, oh, don't hurt them, don't hurt them. And so they had bonded with their perpetrators, and that's what human beings do. It's a survival technique. It's not coming from the smartest part of our brain, but it's coming from a survival place in our brain, and it's a very primitive defense. But that's what happens to human beings when we're held hostage and we feel trapped and we feel like, you know, the end is near. We will make a last ditch attempt to survive. It's called a trauma bond.
You remember Patty Hearst?
Patty Hearst, yeah, exactly the same thing happened to her. She became a bank robber. I mean, they raped her, they put her in the closet, they deprived her.
She was kidnapped, though.
She was kidnapped, right. But they broke her down psychologically.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, all of us were convinced that we were going to help the world become a better place. All of us, this was during a time, this was in the late 70s, during the 80s was for the most part when I was with him. And people were involved in all kinds of movements to, quote, transform the world. I mean, there were the Hare Krishnas, Rajneesh people at the airport, and the Moonies came about. Then there were all kinds of consciousness raising movements. I had been very involved with S, and it was just something that was happening in our culture, and it was in other areas of the world too. I knew someone in Peace Corps who disappeared with the Children of the God movement. So there was something happening in the cultures at that time, in maybe, if you will, mass consciousness, where people wanted to raise their consciousness and help the planet. And the Rajneesh movement, the Moonies movement, they were all extremely abusive, as was what we got involved in.
Yeah,
Jones,
good times, huh?
Yeah.
Good times.
Well, at least we didn't have to drink the Kool-Aid, right? So, I mean...
Yes, thank gosh. Thank goodness.
Yes, I'm very grateful for that.
Well, you know, it sounded like y'all went through a lot of trauma.
We did. Yeah, we really did.
Now, was it more emotional trauma? Or, again, you know, you did mention being physically abused.
Yeah, all of us were physically abused. Most of us ended up with broken teeth, or three of us who have permanent hearing damage.
Oh my God.
Yeah, he broke my nose. I mean, you know, various and sundry things. And it was all, you know, since then I've learned that God is a God of love. But, you know, we were told that we were being punished for our past sins, you know, our karma or whatever the reason was. Probably that, you know, that we were short of being destroyed like Sodom and Gomorrah, that type of thinking. And we bought into it. I mean, you know, we were
manipulated.
You were manipulated. Yeah.
And
yes,
I would bet this man knew how to work with energy, because he would energy overlays where you couldn't break free. And that's, you know, you mentioned the battered woman. And, you know, the guy batters her, and everybody can see it but her, because he's got such a strong overlay over her. Only did he manipulate you through mentally, but, you know, on a physical level.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's definitely an energetic overlay, because, you know, people retreat from the present moment, just like a turtle withdraws into its shell. And it would become like in a trance. And so that overlay is like the fog, the mental, emotional fog that's around us. It's, you know, in psychological terms, it's called dissociation. And that was encouraged And whenever we started to come back to ourselves, we were battered to send us back into that fog, that mental fog. And that's the energy overlay that you're referring to. It's very real.
So how in the world did you manage, and what got you to actually leave?
Well, as I write in the book, several times I escaped because I kept thinking, if I'm serving God, I'm trying to do the highest work, right, to become more spiritual. It shouldn't be so painful. I shouldn't have all of my needs and rights disrespected. And so, so I tried to leave several times, and I would keep getting pulled back because for various number of reasons. But in that process, I would check in with familiars. Like one time I escaped to my mother's, I escaped to my grandmother's a couple of times. And I had people from my former life, you know, before I met him, tell me that, you know, I could serve God, but their God was a God of love. I didn't have to go through this. And actually some strangers that we met relayed the same message. And it started to sink in. It was like a little piece of the puzzle was put back inside of me, and another piece and another piece. And people's kindness and compassion instead of, you know, judgment and rejection, that's what had gotten me into that situation in the first place. Their kindness and the relationships that were offered to me were what helped me get back in touch with myself. And so then I just had to prove that, quote, my mission was over. And so I asked for this miracle that if I had six pennies that turned up heads, then I was done. And at one particular point, I tossed them up in the air and they all came up heads. And I knew because a couple of other of the conditions had met, he had run out of money. He had tons of people giving him lots and lots of money, but his support system had dried up. And he always said that my work would be done when his financial support was eroded. And sure enough, we didn't have any money and I had my sign. So I felt that I had completed whatever it was that I needed to do. And I was able to emancipate myself. And then I was a very broken individual, and my family, my friends, and I went into therapy for the first time in my life, helped me reconstitute myself, you know, put myself back together again.
When you left him the last time, did he try to keep coming after you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, in badgering me with, you haven't completed your mission. What about this? What about that? And, you know, it was very clear. Excuse me. Go ahead.
Oh, did you get a restraining order?
No. No. No, but I learned how to find my voice and learned about my rights and learned how, and this all in the book, you know, how I told him that he was the last person on earth that I would want to have dinner with and la, la, la. So
you had anything else with. So now you've actually turned this really tragic event and, you know, some really harsh lessons into a positive. And how did you decide to become a therapist?
Well, I actually had, the first time I'd ever been in therapy, I was in bioenergetic therapy, which is a mind-body form of discipline. I mean, instead of just talking about it, you actually feel and try to work through the trauma in your body. And I was breathing and asking God why. And I just started sobbing because of just what I had gone through. And I asked that a lot, but this time I heard in my head, go back to school, get a job, you know, study psychology. And that was essentially the answer why. In other words, get a life, but study psychology. And that wasn't told, but it was inferred, and you'll figure it out, you know. And it really helped. It filled in a lot of the blanks. It's called emotional intelligence. Intellectual quotient has really nothing to do with your emotional level of maturity. And when you don't get those emotional needs met when you're growing up or when you've suffered trauma, like, you know, you have post-traumatic stress disorder, it dishevels the brain. And it's very difficult to be grounded, to make rational decisions, because our fear will hijack us, or our anger. I was kind of rageful for a while, and I wrote about that. because I wanted people to know that there are ways other than being an idiot on the freeway to work through your rage. But it took me learning by experience. You know, I got a ticket and I realized that I had an anger issue. And went into deep therapy. So it's pretty predictable if we study human behavior. We're pretty predictable people. I mean, we have certain needs. When those needs aren't met, we are less than an optimum self. We're not very social. We're kind of like dog eat dog. And so I started recognizing that this was kind of predictable for me, and it made it much easier to forgive myself, because I think that's very important, that we not harbor grudges and not hate, but really try to understand one another.
So you've actually forgiven this man?
Yes, yes. And myself. That was the hardest, to forgive myself. Oh, you know, I really realized that I had hated myself all along. The traumas had remained within me unresolved, and the emotions that I had around it, I identified as being who I was, and I hated the things that had happened to me. And the hatred really ended up being mirrored to me through his behavior.
You know, I do understand, because I've been around a master manipulator myself.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they try to put everything on you.
Yeah.
And, you know, they do no wrong, but it's always you doing it. And if you catch them in a lie or doing something wrong, it's like, well, what were you doing there to begin with? You know,
exactly.
I mean,
it's fun on you.
Oh, yeah. They just spin it around.
Right.
Wow. You know, so let's just, what are some of the signs the person you're letting into your life is a potential abuser?
Well, that's a really good question, Kathy. First of all, when your choices are restricted, where you find you're making really impulsive changes, your choices and your freedom are both being restricted, when you feel like you're being controlled, those are signs that someone is moving in to take you over. You feel smothered, maybe don't have any time or space apart from them. You know, like if someone's Velcroed to you and then they have a lot of criticism for you in a controlling way, excuse me, if they don't validate your choices, those are signs that you're being set up to be abused. And it just, you know, if it's really important that we know our rights and that we articulate our displeasure with someone when they're steamrolling over our boundaries. Boundaries are very important.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. All right. So what are some of the signs that you are emotionally vulnerable?
When this is where this person is not really clear about him or herself, so they rarely state their preferences, and they usually concede to choices of others, like someone who says, you know, where do you want to eat? Oh, I don't know. And, well, come on, you know, it's your turn to choose. Well, I don't really know. There's an emotional vulnerability in that inability to say, well, I want to eat hot dogs tonight, or I want to go to a vegetarian restaurant. You know, we all have preferences.
You mean it's just not being a Gemini and not being able to make a decision?
Even Geminis have polar extremes, right? You know, I mean, like hot dogs one night, vegetarian the next, right? Organic, let's go organic. But yeah, no, it's not just being a Gemini, but that was a good one. You're emotionally vulnerable. For instance, if someone can talk you into something, or, you know, into experience something, buying something that you really didn't want to do. You know, like, say, someone says, let's go bungee jumping. And I use this as an example because I'll never bungee jump. I mean, I think life is very precious to me right now, since I pretty much let someone try to destroy it, and myself too. So, and you, no, I don't really want to. Oh, come on, it'll be fun. And eventually you end up bungee jumping, you know, terrified. And that's, you know, that's someone has played or preyed upon your emotional vulnerability. So if you're impulsive, that's not real good. You know, we need to pause and really reflect before we do things. Unless, you know, you're on the railroad tracks and the train's coming, that's a good time to be impulsive to get off. But another more signs about being emotionally vulnerable, you're not able to contain or think through your emotions, and that comes with emotional impulsivity. You know, it's really difficult sometimes for people, excuse me, to feel the anxiety of not knowing. Well, that's okay because that's an opportunity for the mystery to inform us, and for us to grow a little bit in being able to tolerate frustration, being able to tolerate not knowing, and to learn patience. It's a virtue, really. And sometimes we forget that as we drum our fingers in front of the microwave, right? So you think your worth is dependent on your income, your beauty, you know, social status, presence on social media, where your sense of self is validated by what's external to you instead of what's internal to you. In other words, people who have peace of mind or sense of well-being, that comes from within us. And when we're mindful of the brain and all of its emotional flip-flopping, but we have this steadiness about us. And when we're impulsive and, you know, someone makes a negative comment about our hair and, you know, the world is ending, that's, you know, someone who's very vulnerable. And of course, when we're young, we're incredibly vulnerable.
Yeah, then they just push the kids onto drugs.
Yeah, I mean, the reason for that, or any kind of distracting behavior, video games are big now. Social media is big. We can lose copious amounts of time with the internet or with our electronics. And the reason for that is it's a dissociative place, or the trance place. It's the turtle withdrawing in its shell. It's that place where we numb out. We don't feel the pain of not belonging. We don't feel the pain of our emotional vulnerability, or that we don't really have many friends. And it's like a drug, because it keeps us numb to reality, because the fear is so great, we don't feel we can move through it. And it really takes the support of another. Come on, let's go out, get in the sun, walk around, you know, shoving your kids outside to play, not shoving them out, I mean, inviting them to go out. I don't know which one I say. I'm just, anyway, I
We've
don't
all
mean
been
that.
there, but it's really okay from one mother to another. We've been there, and
Yeah,
we've
but you don't
used
want to
those
lock them
words.
outside, so.
But sometimes you do push them out the door and go,
Yes, go play. Yeah. And
go play.
pretty soon they find that they're having fun. And you see they're alive in their bodies. Their bodies are growing and developing. Their intellect is being stimulated. We grow through play. We connect through play, through pleasure. You know, people gather around food, pleasure, and fire. You know, we're social creatures. And so if, you know, someone's gaming, they're setting themselves up to be incredibly emotionally vulnerable. But that's also just kind of a better than substance abuse, but it's along that same rabbit hole. They're setting themselves up for being socially disengaged and
Well, it is.
isosocial.
And yeah, I'm sorry, I've got
No.
boys, and at one time, when they were in their teens, they played Halo, and that's a military game. And it affected my one son. I had to take it away from him because it's like you're fighting, you're in war. You know, his testosterone got up and he started attacking his sister and
Oh
really
dear.
being obstinate, you know, like, "Urgh." And I was like, this doesn't work for me. And we had so many fights over it. But I can see how it can change you. And what are some of the signs that your child is emotionally vulnerable?
They're socially withdrawn. They lack healthy friends. They have poor school performance. They're maybe afraid to try new things. You know, they're really hesitant to go outside of their comfort zone. At the frontier of every new thing, the growth edge that we're approaching will be fear, because the brain fears what's different or unusual. That's a survival mechanism. You know, the our ancients that, you know, thought that the fuzzy rock was safe, you know, they didn't pass on their DNA. But the automatic reaction to difference is where prejudice comes from. This is where judgments come from. You know, it's really important that we not stay locked into that more primitive part of the brain, but we are socially engaged. But if you see someone who's not, or who's pulling back, not having healthy friends, that's a sign that they're emotionally vulnerable. When children have to have everything perfect, that shows that they're really afraid to fail, because it's a fear, beg your pardon, of being rejected. You know, if it's not perfect, then I won't be loved. It won't be good enough, because their bottom line relationship with themselves is, I'm not good enough. And so if I'm perfect, or for instance, in my deal, I was trying to save the world, then I'll be loved. So, and then they have exaggerated fears of failing, and that goes along with the need to be perfect. If a child is exhibiting those signs, they need support. They need more support than maybe another child who doesn't suffer from those things. You know, social isolation decompensates us, and that's another way of we mentally and socially deteriorate. You know, there's nobody more isolated than the homeless, and, you know, they're not very socialized, and they're very isolated, and you know, there's a window that closes with human beings that they're not able to be rehabilitated. So children have tremendous, what we call neuroplasticity. All it takes is for someone to show up and care for them, be interested in them, validate them, honor their feelings, take an interest in them, spend face-to-face time, not sitting, you know, next to one another watching TV, but eyeball to eyeball, go out and play catch with them, you know, in that in-between time, driving them home from school, hey, how was it? You know, what's going on? Get to know their friends. You know, that's a way of insulating or inoculating your kids from becoming emotionally vulnerable and from becoming bullied.
Now, for adults, would you say that it's really be a good idea to join a support group?
Well, we all need support. If people have been violated, yes, they could greatly benefit from a support group. You know, like there are all kinds of, they call them survivor groups or self-help groups. And, that they are usually self-run and self-led and what's based on a social model. So, you know, people who've been through whatever trauma they're wanting to heal from, help the new ones coming in. You know, like AA is really famous, codependence is. So if you've suffered a trauma or you feel isolated, it would be very important to find a group or at least another, not to remain isolated, but to find someone with whom you can share and receive support. And of course, we hope that our families can do that, and we hope that our partners can do that. But sometimes it takes a little bit more. You know, it takes a village to raise a child. It really takes a village to maintain a healthy community. You know, we need to come together to support
one another. I agree. Now, you're a therapist, and
yes,
you really help others find peace, harmony, and fulfillment in their lives.
So.
Okay.
I hope so. I'm not perfect, and, you know, I fail to do that as well. So it's my intention to do that.
Well, somebody's got to do it, darn it. Is there a technique that you give people to center themselves or actually find that peace, you know, some kind of breathing, or
yes,
what do you recommend that they do?
Well, research has shown that people who bounce back from trauma, we call that resilience, have support, they have a grounded connection, they reintegrate into their bodies, and they learn how to manage their emotions, and they have interpersonal support that offers them empathy and compassion. And so that's ideally what therapy needs to do. And our breathing regulates our emotions. You know, when we have little sippy breaths, we send danger, danger, warning, warning signals to the brain. And so that's what generates panic and panic attacks. And, you know, the old expression, whistle if you're afraid, it's to get you to start breathing. And people who are depressed typically have very shallow breathing as well. So breath is in and of itself self-regulating. One of the reasons that people feel better after exercise is because they've engaged in deep breathing. Singing does the same thing. And the body needs to move. You know, bodies were designed to move. And the more still you are, the more, you know, the ultimate stillness is death. And so the mind-body techniques that I use are to get people to breathe, to become aware of their emotions. Dan Siegel, a famous interpersonal neurobiologist, calls it, he's a psychiatrist, and he says, name it, tame it. And I add, feel it, heal it. And so it's a matter of our attention is what heals. I mean, if you've had children, you know that if they skinned their knee or, you know, some mishap occurred that isn't like a life-threatening or, you know, a hospital visit, they would run to you, mommy, mommy, you know, and all you needed to do is pay attention to them, kiss it, and boom, they're back out there playing again because it's the attention that heals, the attention from another, our own attention. And so, you know, we call that mindfulness now, but it's attention to the body. The body needs breath, the body needs movement, and the body needs comfort. We need connection. We're social creatures, you know, we need to be touched. We need to know that we belong. So those are the things that I like to establish with people, and it can make a profound difference in a person's life. And of course, just being heard, a burden shared is half the burden. And that's one of the benefits of psychotherapy, is that you get to tell your stuff, and it's not going to get broadcast around the community. No one's going to make fun of you. And it's really, you leave it there and you try to find better ways, a person tries to find better ways to live their life. It's kind of like the village listener, you know, the shaman or, you know, whomever was the wise person. That's what psychotherapy can become.
Well, that's I was just going to toss out at you, and funny you brought up shaman, that you've also experienced a lot of mysticism in your life. And
Yes.
how does that, how do you integrate that in your therapy?
Well, legally, I cannot do that to be a licensed marriage and family therapist, but what I like to do is use the connection that I think we all have with our essence. I mean, Einstein said that he called it the unified field, where we're all connected, and he was a very wise man. And most people are recognizing that there's this spark that leaves when the body dies, and I, you know, I call that the essence, the soul, whatever, you know, the spark of God, whatever you want to call it. But to get people in touch with that is, I think, is very powerful. So that was what I was being facilitated in getting in touch with, and it was kind of molding me in a direction that, you know, this is where I am. I'm not done yet. I hope to continue growing. But I don't do readings anymore. I don't do any of that kind of stuff, just because what I found in traveling around with this guy, we were like spiritual vagabonds. We were doing readings for people and trying to help. And no matter how many times you told someone that their essence was beautiful, you know, because they're made in the image of God or whatever that was, it didn't go through because of the emotional overlay, because of the wounds and the trauma and the misperceptions of self that the ego defenses that are in the brain had developed. And I mean, it worked for it. The same applied to me. I didn't know I deserved better. And so I felt like being a therapist to help remove that armoring, to help remove or transform those self-perceptions that were skewed, would be the most powerful way of getting people in touch with their essence.
So, what do you hope readers will take from your book?
I hope they will learn about themselves, and they will learn more about humanity, that they will be curious about their purpose, and hopefully they will develop more empathy for the less privileged and the dysfunctional. And most of all, I hope it's a journey of reading one woman's wacky journey to self, and maybe they can learn something from it to apply to their lives. I mean, very vulnerable in that process. And I think that, like Brené Brown says, that vulnerability is the birthplace of innovation, creativity, and well-being. Well, there are two kinds of vulnerability, and I hope that they recognize that there's a vulnerability where you get set up for shame and annihilation, or emotional annihilation. And there's vulnerability where we listen, we're not jammed with the yada yada, but we take in nature, we take in a pause to appreciate what we have, that we feel our connection. So that's what I'm hoping will happen. That's pretty grandiose, but I wrote it with the idea to serve.
So the book's called Sanity, Lost and Found, and where can they get the book?
Oh, it's on Amazon, or you can just ask for it in any major bookstore.
How easy is that? And can they also get a hold of you to do any counseling?
I would not do any counseling over the phone. I'm going to have a website with blogs. I'm hoping that helps. I'm a firm believer in face-to-face contact is really what we need, or voice-to-voice. But if people are interested, they can access my website, which is being launched in about 2 weeks. It's called sanitylostandfound.com. And I have an email address, again, sanitylostandfound@cox.net. But I'm really not wanting to engage in online or phone counseling. I'm hoping that people will find others locally where they are, because you really need to have an ongoing connection. If we're going to heal, we need to have someone consistently supporting us, not just a phone call. I mean, phone calls are nice, but if you know the person. So
are you in California?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Well, we narrowed the state down, people. Okay. Well, thank you, Tara. I've really enjoyed having you on, and
thank you, Kathy. It's been an honor, truly. Thank you.
I know it's a hard subject to talk about, and I'm sorry for your experiences, but thank you for writing this great book.
Well, thank you. And actually, anymore, I'm not sorry. I'm actually grateful. I quote Nietzsche in the book that your worst enemies are your greatest teachers, and I've come to believe that if we work at this stuff long enough, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. It's not always easy, and it's certainly not about anything being fair, but I think that is available to us.
And you earn the grace.
Yes, we do. I think we do earn the grace. It's not about an eye for an eye. It's really about compassion and empathy, and forgiveness.
Those are human traits. Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you again. And
thank you.
Your book
is
called Sanity Lost and Found.
Yes. A true story of brainwashing and recovery. It's a long time.
So, everybody, thank you very much. And I hope you have a wonderful week. And, God sends you a heart's desire.
Yeah.
And on that note, aloha.
Thank you again. Bye. Aloha.
Good night.